just two buildings east of the Epworth Euclid Methodist Church, which is the church which we pass after we've come down the hill on our way to the main temple. There's a three-story brick office building, which includes, among other tenants, on its first floor, the only black bank which has been chartered in this area. On the third floor, there's a family planning clinic, an abortion clinic. And several weeks ago, when I was pondering what to speak on this morning, you have to have the list ready for the bulletin a month in advance because of the printing schedule. I was on my way down to the main temple, and in front of that building, as there has often been in the past, there were a group of youngish women, children, picketing on the sidewalk, bearing those placards which read, "Adoption, not abortion, thou shalt not murder," and so on. In February of 1978, 14 months ago, a man dressed in a blue delivery uniform gained entrance to this clinic, threw gasoline in the face of one of the laboratory technicians, poured gasoline on the floor and ignited it, torched the offices, ran out. He escaped, and though the police searched for the man, he is still at large. Some of those who are active in these abortion clinics in Cleveland believe that the police did not really search with too great diligence for the arsonist. The 5th District Police Station is just across the street, and the police come from many of the same areas in society who have turned what they call the Right to Life movement into one of the most active, embittered, determined crusades to be seen in this century on the political scene in America. I have never spoken publicly on the issue of abortion. I think in largest measure out of a deep feeling that men have spoken too often over the centuries on this theme, and it's really not our theme. But the bitterness and the power of this new anti-abortion crusade, I think, requires that something be said. Certainly, all of us are going to have to make a series of civic and political decisions forced on us by these crusaders. And I think we ought to be as clear in our own mind about what it is that we really believe and where we really come down. How shall we measure the force of this crusade? Well, about a dozen abortion clinics around the country have been arsoned in the last year or so. A new political party, the so-called Right to Life Party, has emerged in a number of states, a single-issue party, which has fielded at local and at state levels candidates, and in 1978 in New York State polled more votes than did the traditional third party in New York, the Liberal Party. Since a Supreme Court decision in June of 1977, which declared that it was not obligatory upon the states to provide support for abortions through public funds, the Congress of the United States and most state legislatures have passed what are called Hyde Amendments, amendments to health, education, and welfare program bills, which prohibit the use of these monies for any purpose which would support abortive surgery. And all of us have seen the parading and the placarding, such as I saw that day. There is no congressperson, there's nobody in the state legislature who escapes from the lobby. and almost every candidate for public office anywhere at any level is required somehow to state his position, even if that position is not one which would require him to make a decision one way or another on the issue. Those who are convinced that abortion is murder and must be prohibited at all costs have made it a point of honor to build up what's called a hit list, a list of representatives who will not vote the way they want to vote, and whatever else other their qualifications may be, they have gone about to unseat these people and to replace them by those who are more supportive. Let's look then this morning a little bit at this difficult issue. First, what does Judaism have to say on it? The Bible, the Torah, has only one reference to abortion. It is a rule, a law, which duplicates almost exactly the conventional rule in the Bronze Age in West Asia, a law which is quoted in almost identical terms in the Code of Hammurabi, a law which states simply that if a woman is pregnant, and she is involved in a quarrel, or she is close to those who are quarreling, and she is hit, and the child is stillborn, the assailant, the person who delivers the blow, is to pay a heavy fine. And if the woman dies because of complications, because of the blow, the assailant is liable to death. It's a capital crime. And that's all that the Bible has to say about abortion. It reminds us that the ancient literature is not very useful in this issue, because abortion, in the modern sense, as a modern problem, can emerges only once medical science has reached a certain plateau, as it has now, where surgery is simple and easy and inexpensive. Today, only a little over 3 out of every 100,000 abortions ends in a fatality. And this is to be compared with about 12 per 1,000, per 100,000 live births. Surgery, antiseptics, have raised the possibility of abortion as a simple procedure which can be determined upon by the woman at her will. In the days of the Bible, it was simply a matter of accident. As medicine developed a little more, it became possible to think of some kinds of crude surgery, particularly that surgery which might be delivered, be given at birth or just before birth, if the delivery was particularly difficult and in some way endangered the life of the mother. And so it is that the classic text in the Mishnah, the text on which all rabbinic discussion is based, reads simply, if a woman is in labor and it is feared that she may die, one may sever the fetus from her womb by extracting it member by member, because her life takes precedence. Abortion was an issue in the second century when this law was set down. It's probably a much earlier rule, but it's there in the second century text. At term, when the question was the life of the fetus or the life of the mother. And Jewish law came down very strongly on the side of preserving the life of the mother. Judaism has never believed in absolutes, in the sense that there are not subtle and elegant distinctions to be made between life and life. The mother is a grown being, is an independent being, has had experience, is alive. The life of the child is yet uncertain. The infant is not yet born. It is totally dependent. Its life is not quite worth the life of the mother if it is a question of choosing between the two. And over these long centuries, the rabbis of traditional Judaism have remained within this particular legal stance. They've argued from that abortion is permitted when it is a matter of saving the life of the mother, when the life of the mother is seriously endangered. A minority of traditional rabbis have rather elaborated what do they mean by endangering the life of the mother. And they've argued that this would include physical harm and psychological harm. And so you can find here or there among the poskim, those who decide these things in traditional Judaism, arguments which are made that in cases of rape, or in cases such as the thalidomide cases, if the mother is liable to be paralyzed by emotional fear, become hysterical, have a mental breakdown, if her life is endangered in that way, an abortion is to be allowed. But even those who would allow abortion in these kinds of cases make it very clear that the basis of their decision is not that an infant, if it is perhaps deformed, has no claim in life. Its claim is absolute, provided its claim does not intrude upon the possibility of further life for the mother. In the United States, most of those who are affiliated with traditional Jewish organizations, religious organizations, have affiliated themselves with the Right to Life movement, with the anti-abortion movement. They argue, as do the Right to Life movement, that the whole concept of abortion on demand, the whole idea that a woman has the right to choose once she conceives whether or not to deliver the child, is an unacceptable idea. For there is no danger to the life of the mother involved here. It is not a question of balancing out subtle claims. What is involved here, they would say, is simply the issue of selfishness. The mother does not want to have the child. The child will endanger or limit the mother in the development of a career. The argument is that a woman's role is to bear children. The first law of the Bible is to be fruitful and to multiply. And in the old attitudes, the old texts, this law is not to be cavalierly set aside. They would argue further that one must build fences around the law. This concept of siyagim, offenses, is an old one. It's a kind of moral domino theory. It argues that there must be elaborations on a basic law in order to protect its core. The law requires Sabbath rest. All the elaborations, all the don'ts that appear in the Talmudic literature exist because it is necessary to build fences around the basic principle that the Sabbath is a holy day to be set aside for rest, for study, for worship, for family. And so they would argue that we must at all costs preserve the sanctity of life. We must never take a cold-blooded attitude towards that which is alive. Because if we do so in the minor case, we will tend to become more cavalier and cold-blooded in the major cases, euthanasia, eugenics, the kinds of manipulation of life which all of us are concerned with. And they argue further that to allow abortion on demand is to suggest that the purpose of life is essentially hedonistic. It is simply to fulfill oneself. While in truth, the purpose of life is to live in community, to learn to love and to share and to be related with another. And then when we begin to make a series of very selfish decisions, that involves simply the child will get in my way, that such a decision is in fact one which simply increases the cold-bloodedness, the callousness of that individual soul and is therefore to be avoided. Now, I would argue that the legal domino theory, that is, that one must build these kinds of fences against abortion in order to preclude eugenics or euthanasia, does not hold water. In Sweden, in the 1920s, there were very liberal laws concerning abortion. In Germany, in the 1920s, there were very strict laws about abortion. Abortion was possible only if there was a direct, provable physical threat to the mother. And yet it was in Germany, not in Sweden, that Dr. Mengele and the others began to human experimentation, It was in Germany, not in Sweden, that they swept through the old folks' homes and disposed of all those who were not being contributing members of the society. There is no argument that can be made from historical evidence that when a society loosens up in the area of abortion, it necessarily plunges down the road which leads to a contempt for human life, for old age. Indeed, one of the unhappiest elements in the present anti-abortion crusade is the assumption that those who are concerned with limiting and prohibiting abortion are the only ones who are concerned with the quality of life, with the sanctity of life. There are many men, many women of deep religious and spiritual attainment, people of sensitive souls who are concerned and have proven their concern for mankind in a thousand ways, who believe that there is a certain force to the argument that an unwanted child is an abused child, will be deprived of love, will be looked upon as the cause of the mother or the family's unhappiness. It will be denied the full opportunity for life in an era where the question is not to keep alive as many as we can because there's a constant threat of underpopulation in an era such as ours where there are so many, and the question is to develop the skills of those who are alive as fully as we can, to continue to bring into this world unwanted children who will be deprived of love and therefore never know how to love, will be looked upon as impediments to the progress of the family rather than as wanted children who contribute to the happiness of the family, that to do so is not to add to the reverence of life, but simply to add to the number of problems which the living must face. What of the argument that somehow by permitting abortion on demand, we are contributing to a certain kind of individual spiritual callousness, that we are allowing people to grow up to believe that they have the right to determine what they need to do, that nobody else can tell them what to do, that if an embryo, a fetus stands in their way, they have the right arbitrarily to dispose of it. It is this argument, I suspect, which gives most of us pause. Because when all is said and done, there has been, there is, in this argument that abortion should exist on demand, a certain reflection of the hedonism, which is rampant in our society, of the radical demand for total independence, which exists, a demand which often knows no limits and few restraints, and which has allowed many people to grow up with great opportunity, to use that opportunity only to develop their own selfish desires, not to develop the human traits within them, empathy and sympathy and love and compassion and relationships, those things which allow us to create community. When all is said and done, and we look at the tradition, we respect our tradition for not having taken the absolutist position which is taken in recent years by the Roman Catholic Church, is taken in our times by many of the anti-abortion groups, that after conception, any abortion for any reason is in fact an act of murder. Our tradition knew that there were reasons to take the fetus. The preservation of life is, after all, an overwhelming reason. One of the things which surprises many when we discuss this question of abortion is the recognition that the adamancy of the Roman Catholic Church in this area is of rather recent vintage. In point of fact, until 1869, the church was of two minds. There were church fathers beginning in the 3rd and 4th century when this discussion was first broached seriously, who argued on the basis not of the New Testament but of their knowledge of Pythagorean Greek philosophy, that the soul entered the body on conception, and therefore that embryo had the right to all of the sacraments, and therefore that any act of abortion after conception was in fact murder. But interestingly, if you read St. Augustine, or if you look at the great 6th century Justinian Code of the Church, or you read most of the legal experts of the church who wrote during the Middle Ages, you will find that they argue that the soul does not enter the body until the 40th day, and that any taking of the fetus before that 40th day is in fact not an act of murder, because the soul does not exist in the fetus until that arbitrarily chosen time. The 18th and 19th centuries were a time in which the church felt itself embattled by the rise of nationalism in Italy, by the rise of modernism. The church did exactly what the traditional synagogue did. It became less rather than more open. It had the capacity to maintain an older tradition, but in the 19th century, the church closed itself in more and more from the outside world in order to preserve itself from the batterings, from the pressures, from the seductive attraction of the outside world. And so in 1869, Pope Pius IX, one of the most conservative of all the men who have occupied the seat in Rome, issued a bull which established the present position of the church, which is an absolutist one, which allows for no argument that during the early stages of pregnancy, in fact, abortion is not murder. There are within the church then, as within the synagogue, the traditional synagogue, all kinds of arguments that could be made if one was in a different posture, in a different mode, which would allow for all kinds of adjustments to the question of abortion, provided we're dealing with questions where life is endangered, physically, psychologically, or otherwise. But nowhere in the great religious traditions of the West will you find confirmation for the view which is sponsored today, that abortion is a right, an absolute right of the prospective mother, and she alone must choose whether to abort the child or not. Now, I suggested to you earlier that these earlier traditions are really not very helpful when it comes to the modern issue, because they faced a condition quite unlike our own. They lived before surgery was safe. They lived before a time in which one could, in fact, almost absolutely guarantee to a woman that if early enough in her pregnancy she came to a competent physician, she could, within the day, be delivered of the fetus and be back at her work. There were 1.5 million abortions in the United States last year, and none of them really made the headlines. It's a matter which is simply taken for granted as part of the ordinary course of events. So our question is a different one. It has to do with our reaction not to a condition which is an emergency condition where we must balance various claims on life, but it has to do at a much earlier stage in the pregnancy, and has to do where we must balance our conceptions of virtue, our understanding of the sanctity of life, our feelings of the direction which we would like human growth in the society to develop. I am rather convinced that as a rabbi, I cannot fault the Supreme Court decision of 1973, which prohibited the states from interfering in the right of a woman to seek abortion before the birth of a child. I take that position without joy. I don't think it's a great accomplishment that we finally legitimatize abortion by choice. I look at it rather as a question, as one of those oil spills after off a great tanker, where we have to go and, you know, in a sense, clean up in the most effective way we can for an accident which should have been avoided if possible. But I would argue that in modern times, in a society such as ours, which is heterogeneous, where you have people of differing attitudes and differing moral stances who are equally good, equally sensitive, equally empathetic and concerned, that it is wrong for the society to try to impose its particular majority consensus upon sizable minorities. It doesn't work. All of us remember the 18th Amendment and Prohibition. Another amendment to the Constitution prohibiting abortion would not work. It's estimated that there were 400,000 illegal abortions in the United States in 1972. the year before the famous Supreme Court decision. The symbol of the broken coat hanger, which pro-abortion groups carry around with them, is a very compelling one, because it reminds us of the back alleys, of the butchers, of the blackmail, of the unnecessary guilt, of the fear, of all those things which accompanied abortion before abortion was legalized and allowed to come out in the open to be dealt with surgically, professionally, in an intelligent way. And I would hold that it is far better for it to be handled in this way than as it was when it went underground. For you can be sure of that, that if a constitutional amendment were to be passed and abortion would be to be declared illegal, there would be hundreds of thousands of abortions nevertheless, and there'd be needless loss of life by mothers who have went to in desperation to seek help and found that those who could give them qualified help closed their doors because of the law on them. It seems to me that it is far better for our society to deal with this problem openly and medically and professionally than to deal with it as if it were a crime. It seems to me that those who have pressured for this kind of absolute prohibition of abortion are not only trying to impose a particular theological position upon the country, but more than that, they are callous and relatively indifferent to the amount of harm, psychic and physical harm, that they would cause. I'm troubled by the fact that as they have these groups have begun to pressure more and more with some political success to achieve these ends, all they have really achieved is to increase the sum total of human unhappiness. The Hyde Amendment, the amendment which prohibits the spending of federal funds, Medicaid funds, for abortions, and similar limitations which have been passed through various state legislatures and municipal legislatures about the use of public facilities at cost or below cost for abortions. All these bits of regulation have done is to deny to those on welfare, to the poorest in our society, a right which the well-to-do in our society enjoy simply because of their pocketbooks. And all we have done by this kind of activity is to increase the social distance between the rich and the poor, and impose and all that the right to lifers have done is to impose by force upon the poorest, the least able to defend ourselves in the society, their beliefs, and increase the number of births among those who are least able financially to provide for children. One of the things that all of us must do, and when we think of the problem of abortion, is to recognize how many misguided stereotypes we have in our minds. 52% of all the women who come for abortions in the United States are already caring for one or more children. We tend to think of those who seek abortion as the very young, who are ignorant and simply don't want to have it, don't understand how they got into this position, or as those who are too involved in their careers to be bothered with children. But many who come simply cannot bear the burden of another child, financially, psychically, emotionally. It's just too much for them. Unfortunately, all those who have been trying to create municipal and state laws against limiting abortion have managed to harm the quality of life for women who are desperately seeking to care for their families on very little. I find it difficult also to accept the position of those who are crusading now against abortion by choice, on the argument that somehow if we do not draw the line here, our society will become dehumanized. We will become callous. We will treat the aged the same way we treat the unborn. Euthanasia, eugenics,
all of these will appear. Like all movements, those who argue, who have argued for abortion, include among them the selfish and the self-centered and the saintly and the compassionate. But I'm rather convinced that there's a great deal of compassion and of understanding, moral understanding, and high moral principle among those who argue for the right to choose, because they see the consequences of the denial of that right in the lives of so many. They see young girls who lack the opportunity to finish their schooling, to become themselves, because unwittingly and foolishly they became pregnant. They see the welfare mother, burdened with three or four children, who cannot begin to take care of those she has, facing the possibility of another child. They see a society in which all of our women are caught up in pressures that no other generation of women have had to face. For this is the first generation of women who have had the opportunity to emerge from sex-determined roles into personhood. And it's not easy. It's a role which has filled our women with confusion, conflicting goals, conflicting attitudes. Some have gone too far one way and some have gone too far the other, too far in their own minds, not in the judgments of others. Some make a start, pull back, make another start. This generation of young women and younger women, middle-aged women, have had to face a range of possibilities that no other generation in the history of womankind has ever had to face. And the models of their parents, of their mothers and their grandmothers are not adequate for them, because their mothers and their grandmothers did not have the opportunity or the challenge. And the wisdom of the aged is not necessarily relevant to them, because the wisdom of the ages deals with the stable values of an older society, where woman's role was in the home and was glorified by being in the home. But the society could not have accepted the woman out of the home for a whole variety of economic and technological and personal reasons. Caught in this world, there are those who must look upon a child as something that would absolutely destroy their ability to fulfill themselves. And conversely, and this the anti-abortionists have never seemed to understand, there are large numbers in the society who look upon the women who are so-called liberated and who argue that children are an impediment, or that they were going to limit children to children by choice when they are ready, as people who are showing contempt for that which is the very center of their being. One of the facts about the right to life movement is that one can define it to a certain degree sociologically, by socioeconomic class. You find it largely in the lower middle class and among the middle class. You find the people who are picketing are largely young mothers who have deliberately determined that they will not go out and go to work and make a career for themselves. And those who do make the career for themselves and who demand the right to choose are, in their eyes, showing contempt, spitting on, if you will, all that gives dignity and quality to their lives. And to the fact that so many of these women who are involved in the right to life movement are Madame Lafarge's, are so angry and so embittered, so cruel in their reactions, has to do with the fact that so much in the modern society is challenging all those values to which their lives are dedicated. It's shaking the ground on which they stand. And they are arguing for their own dignity when they are making this stance, carrying these placards, and crying out that, you know, abortion is murder. They have devoted their lives to their children. They don't understand those to whom family, marriage, the bearing of children is not the central value. All of us have difficulty understanding the moral stance of another. But if you want to see the confusion in the lives and the spirits of women today, you have only to look at the abortion movement. You have good women on both sides, each of whom in their own, each group of whom in its own way is fighting for its dignity, is fighting for its own way of life, and they're not understanding each other. And that's, in a sense, why so many of us are concerned, deeply concerned, that there's something here that's more than another political lobby operating, seeking some immediate political goal. And that the answer to the abortion controversy, the abortion debate, is not going to be found in new law, but it's going to be found only when the women's groups begin to speak to each other. And when no one speaks in the name of all women, as if there is only one way, the way of liberation, the way of freedom. The women's rights groups have been surprised at the depth and the extent of the women's groups who have opposed the Equal Rights Amendment. They need not be. Those who argue for the right for abortion have been impressed and disturbed by the depth and the extent of the women who argue that their position is immoral. It's not the men who are making that argument so much again anymore, it is the women. And what the women's groups in America need to do, I feel humbly as an outsider, as a man, is to begin to sit down and talk, to dialogue, to do what Catholics and Jews and Protestants of Jews have tried to do over the last 80 years or so. To begin to understand each other so that when they speak with some respect and reverence for the needs, the self-fulfilling needs of those whose attitudes towards motherhood, towards family, may not be those that that particular woman shares. The abortion debate is largely, I think, a debate among women. It's largely a debate as to the basic role that a woman should play. And those of us who would argue that the modern world with its freedoms is essentially a healthy society must be the first to recognize that the largest group in the modern world is pulling back from freedom, is afraid of it. And that none of us can argue that greater freedom has brought greater happiness. The statistics of mental breakdown, of addiction, of alcoholism, of divorce, in the freest societies of the world must give all of us pause. We have lost strength from the extended family. We have lost the strengthening of stable marriages. We have lost the strengthening of rootage in a given place. We have lost the strengthening of neighborhood. All of us are more exposed. And none of us should wonder that there are those who are frightened by one or another of these exposures and who run back to the womb, run back to the old ways, and hold them even dearer than others and other generations may have. I do not look, as I said, upon abortion by choice as a great contribution to civilization. I look upon it as a social necessity. I believe that we are long past the age in which religious groups or political states have the right to impose their particular, peculiar attitudes towards such issues upon human beings. There are too many different ways. We are too different now, each from the other, for that to be effective. But I do believe this, that if there are, as the statistics reveal, 1.5 million abortions a year in these United States, that all of us had better ask why the oil spill. Why is it that there is so much to clean up behind? Because no woman who goes through an abortion is gladdened by it. What is it about our society where for some sex is sport, for others children are a hindrance, for others fulfillment is measured only in material success, where for some pleasure and self-seeking is the only goal, where for some who argue for the sanctity of the family, information about sex and birth control may not be given to the children? What is it about all the confusions of our social life which has allowed us to come to this pass, where so many are growing up innocent and free, where so many are growing up ignorant with a great deal of freedom, where so many are growing up unformed morally, spiritually, socially? What is it in our society where we cannot find a way to support those who want to have children if they cannot support themselves? What is it that makes marriage such a uncertain institution, that those who have children do not necessarily have a home in which to raise the children? What is it that allows us to treat relationships of lust as if they were relationships of love, and to forget that true love must have within it a strong bond of sexual closeness, which can be trivialized in a society which is so overheated sexually as our own? The abortion debate must give all of us pause about the nature of the social condition which we've allowed to evolve. It must give all of us renewed resolve, at least within the circle of the family, of the community of which we're a part, to do all that we can to increase the child, the young adult's awareness of self, awareness of dignity, awareness of the virtues of restraint and of discipline, to remind ourselves that marriage is a sacred institution, and the bonds of marriage are to be lifelong, and the disciplines of marriage are to be kept close. What is it that would teach us again that pleasure does not lie in breaking the bonds, but in strengthening the relationships? That those who think that pleasure is out there somewhere are bound to be disappointed. For pleasure is in the fulfillment of a good life. So it is in the web of satisfactory, love-filled relationships which exist within the context of our home, family, friendships, community. I hope, though I have no reason to hope, that in the next months and years, the anti-abortion debate or the abortion debate will become less frenzied, less angry. I'm afraid that it's one of those issues that it's going to be with us for a long time. It cries out for a response, and the response can not only be political. It cries out for all of us to energize ourselves so that we become centers of sanity, responsibility, people of restraint, people who look again to that which is compassionate and loving and caring, and that which truly respects the individuality of another, so that we look again to the sanctity of family and of marriage and to our own responsibilities within those bonds. In that sense, the right to lifers are right. They are wrong, dead wrong, in believing that they have the right to impose their particular attitude towards an operation on anyone else in the society. They are wrong, dead wrong, when they misjudge the moral quality of others in the society. But they are dead right when they point a finger at the society and say, this whole issue was created by indifference to some old concerns and old virtues, which you, the society, have played fast and loose with. Abortion is the oil spill. There ought to be a way.